Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 706, Interview with John Loftus, titled The Obama Administration as the Last Victim of World War II. This program is being recorded on March 21st of the year 2010. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves a man I consider to be a genuine American hero. That is John Loftus, the author of, among other titles, The Ballara Secret, soon to be republished in uncensored form under the title American Nazi Secrets. That publication is going to be done by Trine Day, one of the few unfettered publishers left in this country. And John is also the author of, with Mark Aaron, The Secret War Against the Jews, Unholy Trinity, and also by himself, the historical novel published only in Canada, The Witness Tree. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thanks, Dave, and I think you've done quite a job over the years in publicizing the fascist connections to a lot of the powers that be in the United States and abroad, so Good job, guy.
All righty. Well, I'm going to keep it up. In fact, speaking of the devil, which we have been doing for quite some time on these interviews, in our last interview, for listeners who are pursuing the archives, For the Record 704, in our last interview, right near the end, you discussed the Obama administration and how it could be viewed as the last victim of World War II. And I was struck by that. That's the sort of thing that I would say. So develop that for us, if you would, John. How would you view the Obama administration as being the last victim of World War II?
During World War II, there was a real fissure in American politics. For years, we had a lot of the old Wall Street types that had invested in pre-war Germany and were stuck when we got in war because technically it was treason to continue giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Well, they did it anyway. They weren't one to walk away from a profit. But the way they decided to cover it up was to divide the American intelligence community and to have Alan Dulles be in charge of a new intelligence agency called the CIA that would coordinate it all. Well, much to Dulles' horror, Dewey lost the election. And so in 1947, we had two distinct intelligence services, one that worked for the Republicans who were out of office, headed by Dewey, headed by Truman, and one that worked for the Democrats. And the Democratic one was often kept in the dark. And that legacy has persisted to this day. So Obama's administration doesn't know that there is one wing of their foreign policy apparatus, one wing of their economic apparatus, one wing of their intelligence apparatus that does not follow American interest. It follows multinational corporate interests.
I've had to fend off so much rhetoric about Obama, for whom I voted. I don't think the guy walks on water. But he's getting attacked by the left as a tool of Wall Street and the corporations. Of course, the right, you know, he's a Bolshevik and he's going to bring communism to America. I mean, good Lord. It's a remarkable discussion.
I think Obama is an honest man who's not a fool, and that's a rarity in Washington that makes him dangerous.
Okay, very good. And so you don't think that he's aware that basically when he walked into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, he walked into a certain extent with a gun to his head?
No, he didn't realize, for example, that when he put Hillary in charge of some Middle Eastern negotiations, that they would blow up so disastrously. I mean, Hillary actually believed, and she's a woman of good intent, that what her staff was telling her, that, look, no problem, Syria's going to change sides, that the Lebanese election is going to go, Hezbollah is going to win that. We have to be realists. We have to deal with the extremists and stop labeling them terrorist groups. We have to, And of course, it was all nonsense. Hezbollah lost the election. They even slipped their parliamentary holdings by one seat. And Obama was furious that he'd been had. And so the gossip is that Hillary has been restricted to, like, North Korean negotiations and a few other little things. But the Middle East has largely been taken away from her and from state. And state actually, tried a few things to revive the old Muslim Brotherhood, to have a Sunni army of right-wing fascists to fight the Shia army of right-wing fascists. Well, it was just a stupid idea. And it's delayed us for years. It may have cost us the opportunity to have a workable financial embargo against Iran at a very critical point in history. But Obama didn't see it coming. He was blindsided by his own people. And that's, been the tragedy politics. I mean, when Truman came in office, he had no idea of some of the things that Roosevelt had been planning. And Roosevelt had only an inkling of how bad things had been with the ultra-right in America.
You know, John, ever so briefly in an encapsulated fashion, because Franklin Roosevelt also is taking hits long after his death. And one of the things you wrote about with Mark Ahrens in The Secret War Against the Jews was something that Roosevelt had in mind, which you referred to as the banker's trial. Develop that briefly for us, if you would.
Well, during the Carter administration, my first boss in OSI was the Nuremberg prosecutor for the banker's trial, Walter Rockler. And he knew that there was something terribly, terribly wrong, that his investigations were obstructed, the money was drying up. He was told to pick of the two banks he was pursuing, just pick one of them and drop the other. So he dropped Deutsche Bank. And the very next day, Herman Abbs became the British advisor on economic policy. So when I was hired, because I'd been an army officer and done some intelligence work, my job was to follow the money. You know, the Nazi stuff was sort of a pretext. He wanted to know who had rigged Nuremberg and why. And I've never told that before, but that's what I did. And I got a very good view on the way the world really worked. I think one of the things that Walter liked was at night I was going to night school for taxation and economic policy, because I wanted to learn how the real big thieves operated. And he was a tax lawyer himself. He knew exactly what I meant. So I was sort of his undercover agent. And as long as the Democrats were in power, Walter and I were safe. When Reagan was elected, then everything went to heck. It was awful. I'm sorry, I missed your original point there, David. I got meandering off.
Yeah, the banker's trial. You wrote that in The Secret War Against the Jews, you wrote that Roosevelt, the Roosevelt administration, was working on getting the German bankers into the docket at Nuremberg so that
they wanted the German bankers to point their fingers at the American bankers and say, wait a minute, what are you blaming us? You know, these are our partners. We just did what they told us. And that would have caused a major disaster because at that time, the Republican Party was largely financed by these East Coast Republicans, the Wall Street and Pennsylvania bankers. And they actually had a special prison set up for the Wall Street bankers' Nazi partners. We actually had American officials in the Nazi banks in Germany during World War II. Treason, okay? Those guys ended up in a special prison, and it was off the books because it had American guards, but it was a British camp. So it was under no one's jurisdiction officially. It was one of those places where all the secret guys went to work. Now, one lawyer from Justice Department was put in charge of it, and his job was to bury the entire scandal. Every one of the traitors was let go. My friends in Army Counterintelligence who had worked on the dossiers were absolutely furious. Remember the lawyer? He was the guy, actually, his last case was the Green Beret murder case. He was the prosecuting lawyer on that one.
Was it the Jeffrey McDonald case?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What,
yeah.
Do you recall?
I was in the Supreme Court the day of the hearing, but he died soon afterwards. But he was the man that buried the scandal of the Nazi bankers. What? Kronberg Castle was the name of it. The castle itself later became the archive center for the West German Intelligence Service, the Galen Organization.
Wow. Do you recall the gentleman's name offhand? The lawyer who was in charge with covering that up and who then...
Not at the moment, but any book on the Green Beret murder trial will bring up his name.
Sure, we'd probably find it on the Internet quickly enough.
Yeah.
And so basically, had Nuremberg not been attenuated, as Mr. Rockler noted, then we would have wound up with some of the top names in American finance in the defendant's docket.
Oh, yeah. My Jewish friends did know some of it. And in my historical novel, we pointed out that they used the information about Rockefeller's investments with Nazi Germany to blackmail him into getting the extra votes needed to create the State of Israel. So a few people knew, a handful of people knew, but it never was known to the American public. I mean, some famous names, Forrestal, was in it up to his neck. It was one of those things that drove him mad. He committed suicide. Frank Wisner also committed suicide. The DuPonts, just terrible people.
And would we not have had some of George W. Bush's ancestors involved there?
Oh, God, yeah. Prescott Bush was running a company called the Silesian American Coal Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And that supplied the coal for a special tar processing plant known to history as Auschwitz. And Auschwitz was built where it was because of a deal between Prescott's American investors, their German investors, and their Russian investors. They needed to have access to a river near a coal plant somewhere close to the Polish-Russian border, because the Russians and the Poles use different rail width, different rail gauges, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so the Russians had actually dug the canals leading to the Vistula rivers because the Russians could bring in raw material.
Mm-hmm.
And the German scientists had a virtual high-tech monopoly, if you will, and the Americans had the money. So they had Auschwitz planned as an international profit center. Of course, afterwards, the whole idea of using slave labor was just a gloss on it that Hitler's people added to it. Yeah, that's why Auschwitz was built where it was built, was because it served the purpose of the American investors.
And the technical process involved, if I'm not mistaken, was the Fischer-Tropsch process, which was the focal point of the Standard IG Agreement of 1929, was it not?
In part, yes, but there was the coal tar additives were essential for the creation of aviation fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what Stalin's Air Force needed desperately.
And the there was an article that you had on your website some years back, the earlier part of the decade, in which a Dutch intelligence source, I think it was, alleged that Prescott Bush Sr., by the way, there's also Prescott Bush Sr., a brother of George H.W. Bush, but Prescott Sr. was in charge of the slave labor pool.
Yeah, this was actually his dad. No, you're talking about Prescott.
Prescott Sr. This would have been the father of George H.W.
The grandfather of President, George, the last president, the father of the previous president.
Exactly,
Prescott Bush, yeah.
Yep.
And he was the son-in-law of Herbert Walker. Herbert Walker was the real evil genius here, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Prescott was just sort of a drunk. You know, his father-in-law gave him a position. He did what he was told.
Right, right.
You know, but he did what he was told. It was evil things. He knew they were evil. So after the war, you know, one of the Dutch bankers discovers that the Dutch bank that he's supposed to be running and auditing is actually a front for Prescott's bank in New York and the Nazi bank in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to New York to blow the whistle to Prescott, and his body is found 2 weeks later of an alleged heart attack.
One thing that stretches through the years are these mysterious... it's interesting that there's discussion about a health bill. I wonder if they're going to have a special provision to cover investigators who want to look into these things. Because another thing you wrote about in that same article was a fellow who had been...
The Dutch investigator.
Yep.
And he, one of the major German investigators, the Bush's partners, had a home right next to Margaret Thatcher in London. And Roper's body was found dead in his car, also of an alleged heart attack.
Wasn't that Mr. Thyssen-Bornemisza?
Yeah, Thyssen-Bornemisza was the family that were the early partners with the Bushes, the Dulleses, and the Rockefellers.
Living right next to Maggie Thatcher.
Yeah. And Thyssen, of course, was a major Nazi war criminal, but was released after serving, I think, 5 years in prison. But his partner in crime, Krupp, the families eventually merged, so ThyssenKrupp is now the largest and wealthiest conglomerate in Europe. And if you look at most of the elevators in America, you'll see the name Thyssen mm-hmm. on the nameplate. So that's who's building your elevators, folks.
Yep. So I guess how fast they go to the basement remains to be seen for all of us here. Another thing that you mentioned right near the end of our last interview, John, and that was that I think it was a year or so ago, the disclosure came to light that the Vatican Bank continued to be the largest launderer of so-called black money, meaning illicit money on Earth. I wonder if you'd develop that for us.
Yeah, it wasn't the largest. It was in the top 10. Actually, I think it came in number 9. That to this day, the Vatican has so few internal and external controls that all you need actually is an account inside the Vatican Bank, and then the whole money trail disappears. No auditing, no external checks. No one knows where the money goes. Because the Vatican, of course, is the only bank whose couriers have diplomatic immunity.
Interesting. And you actually, a few years ago, we've discussed over the years in our various interviews lawsuits that you filed. And you filed one against some of the Muslim Brotherhood fronts in Washington, D.C., and some of their lobbying interests.
I do have a habit of stirring up trouble, I'm afraid.
Well, when you're linking the Muslim Brotherhood, the parent organization of Al-Qaeda, to Grover Norquist and Karl Rove in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, that's certainly going to rub a lot of people the wrong way inside the Beltway.
I just did a story about Representative Campbell out in California, and his major contributors included Muslim Brotherhood members like Sami Al-Aryan, and he was writing letters to get Sami's brother-in-law out of prison as an illegal alien. Now, Sami's brother-in-law, it should be noted, his name was Mazen al-Najjar, was once a teaching assistant in an obscure college in North Carolina where most of the Muslim terrorists went to school. And he actually taught Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. It was a small engineering department, so it's almost certain that he taught Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And the subjects that Khalid studied were aviation power plants and building structure.
Interesting focal point for a liberal arts education, although he was obviously...
No, I'm a Democrat, but I also exposed a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate for also taking money for Al-Aryan, knowing who he was, and so I felt it only fair to do it for the Republicans as well.
Yeah, the right-left paradigm in the current political landscape and climate disintegrates pretty quickly. It's very disturbing to watch the Muslim Brotherhood getting... having people running interference for them from both sides of the aisle. By the way, I want to alert listeners to a very good book. It's a conservative book co-authored by a Hoover scholar, but a very, very good one, and I'm going to be interviewing the author probably more than once as soon as I'm finished, but it's called Muslim Mafia by David Gaubatz.
And I think one of my best friends. And David, by the way, is pro-Muslim. Okay, it's not one of those right-wing Muslim-bashing books. David's life was saved by Muslims. He's very close to them. He is a strong defender of Islam. And he's a Christian, of course. But Dave is one of those very brave people that knows that Islamic extremism is just as much a danger today as Nazi Germany was in 1939. And his son volunteered to pretend to be an Islamic extremist and work for free for, I think it was 18 months, inside the headquarters of one of these groups in the Beltway. And his job was to take out the trash or to shred the sensitive documents every day before putting them in the trash. But what he was doing is he was reading the documents first and taking the good ones home. And so he had a huge collection of all the nasty secrets of CARE, the Congress of American Islamic Relations, and shows that it was just a pawn for Hamas. It was a propaganda group for the Muslim Brotherhood. It was moving money for terrorism, everything that CARE had been trying to conceal. This is very embarrassing because CARE had previously played a covert role with the Muslim Brotherhood back in the dark old days of Afghanistan between 79 and 89. We took the Muslim Brotherhood out of the closet one last time and had them recruit the Mujahideen to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. Now, the CIA, ironically, of course, because it was a Democratic agency, remember we talked about the split, didn't have a clue who was getting the money. The money went from the CIA through the Pakistanis and the Saudis. And they were the ones that put these extreme Muslim Brotherhood members on the payroll.
And the organization, the Committee or Congress on American Islamic Relations, has a reputation as being sort of like the NAACP for the Islamic community as a civil rights group, and it is a Muslim Brotherhood slash fascist slash terror front group.
Absolutely. There is, and your listeners should know that CARE is not C-A-R-E. That's a wonderful charity that does great things in third world countries. This is C-A-I-R. And it is nothing more than a front group. It was an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land trial. It is a terrible, terrible organization. In fact, you know, I ran a charity, an international charity called the Intelligence Summit, where, you know, we brought together people from different intelligence services, and CARE had us be a target. They absolutely called up all of our donors and said, if you don't withdraw your support, all Muslims in the world will boycott you. It was just phenomenal. So, of course, we kept doing it and kept exposing CARE, and now CARE is in deep trouble. It happened to a nicer group.
Yeah, and again, the name of that book is called Muslim Mafia. It's authored by David Gaubatz and also Paul Sperry, I think, is his co-author's name.
And this is a sad thing, is that that book is not getting reviewed. It's a heroic book where they're using actual documents, you know, from their own files to show, hey, look, folks, this is who they are. And these are not spokesmen for the Muslim. They're spokesmen for the 1% of the extremists. and it's not getting reviewed at all. It's terrifying.
Yeah, well, we're gonna be having Mr. Gaubatz on probably more than once, because it's going to take more than one interview to cover the book. But
David's a dear friend, and I think you'll find him a fascinating guy, a kind and gentle man who's very, very brave.
He certainly is, and for someone who is pro-Muslim to take on, by the way, he's a career intelligence officer, worked for OSI, Air Force Intelligence, and for him to take on such a formidable enemy, I know from a rhetorical standpoint, whenever I talk about Islamic fascism, which is a reality in this world, I get excoriated too, because, oh, that's terrible, you know, that's the sort of rhetoric Bush and company use. The fact of the matter is that Islamic fascism is real. It's not to say that all or most Muslims are fascist, but the Muslim community faces the challenge of fascism as
well. Technically accurate, the Muslim Brotherhood was a fascist party. It was the original Arab Nazi movement. Okay? And this is just second-generation people. I mean, Hamas, for example, is the Muslim Brotherhood representative in Palestine, and they still give the Hitler salute.
Absolutely. And so does Hezbollah.
It's not Islamo-fascism. That's technically incorrect. But they are a second generation of the original fascist groups. And all the same Nazi propaganda, the, you know, protocols of the Elders of Zion, the same, you know, dirty propaganda and smear campaigns. It's absolutely typical.
Mm-hmm. And they espouse corporatism, as Mussolini put it, and Hezbollah.
And some of my favorite progressive websites, you know, about, you know, one-tenth of the articles coming up are as if they were written by the Muslim Brotherhood. There's, for some reason, the progressive left has found itself extremely vulnerable to anti-Israel propaganda, and they buy this stuff as if it were true.
Oh, the Bay Area. This, by the way, I want to stress that what I'm about to say is strictly being said by Dave Emery. This is not something John Loftus should or would maybe sign on to. But coming from the left coast, if Adolf Hitler had been a Palestinian lesbian, a large percentage of the people in the Bay Area would be Nazis. I mean, it is surreal. It's the same phenomenon you're talking about. And it's also interesting to I'm pontificating here, one of the things I excel at. But it is interesting to see people on the American left, people who are champions of women's rights and gay rights, aligning with the Muslim Brotherhood, who would kill them.
Oh, you know, it's so sad. I was speaking at a progressive rally and about Afghanistan. I said, you know, we must approach this as a feminist issue. Nowhere in the world are women more mistreated than in Afghanistan under the Taliban. And they just began to boo. They didn't want to hear that, you know, that there was another side of the story. And I said, whatever we do to support the women in Afghanistan, we must do. The Taliban have to go. And they were all prepared to believe the Taliban were the Boy Scouts, the Americans were the oppressors. It was quite the opposite. But and it's tough to sort some of this stuff out.
It is. It is indeed. And I've steered into that particular rhetorical storm myself.
What? I always treat my friends on the progressive left and my friends on the reasonable right with respect, because I can learn a little bit from both. But, you know, I just want to, you know, tell the truth, let the chips fall where they may.
It's one of my favorite phrases, and I've used it on this program in our interviews in the past, but as an old Turkish proverb, he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. John, we were talking about, but it's true, we were talking about the lawsuits that you filed, and obviously you filed them against Muslim fascists. You also sued the Vatican Bank. Encapsulate that for us, if you would.
The Vatican Bank lawsuit was fun because the Vatican had taken money that was stolen by the fascist party in Croatia and had laundered it through the Vatican Bank, through Switzerland, and then to Western Investments. And so what we were doing is saying, well, ordinarily the Vatican would have diplomatic immunity, but not immunity does not apply to people that are melting down gold teeth into gold bars and laundering money that they know has been stolen. You know, that's just common criminal behavior. Diplomatic immunity should not extend that far. And, you know, we lasted pretty well, but the Ninth Circuit, which is usually very generous and very liberal, said, no, this is sovereign immunity protects the Vatican. So we're at the stage now where we're asking for a rehearing from the full panel of the Ninth Circuit, but it'll eventually go to the Supreme Court. But, you know, I'm afraid the Vatican Bank will get away with it. It was a huge theft, not just of Jews, but of, you know, the innocent citizens of Croatia that were robbed point blank. The Franciscan Order was involved. You know, this is just simple theft. And it's you know, years from now, I'm sure, maybe millennium from now, the Vatican archives will be open. And I just want history to record that a few of us were trying to get the story out.
Yeah, another thing that I would like to break some fresh ground here, but John, if you would review for us briefly, because again, we're limited for time. In fact, this will probably have to carry over into side two. But the Vatican Bank's role in helping to finance Nazi industry.
Well, what happened was that the Vatican Bank was established in 1942 because the Nazi government had seized Vatican assets. They were robbing the Vatican blind. And a deal was made that the Vatican could get their money back if they kept their mouths shut about the Holocaust and if they helped German industry move their funds around. Because the Vatican, of course, as a neutral state, still had ties with America and with Great Britain. And so that was done. And the Vatican made the devil's bargain. Now, I'm an Irish Catholic. This is not against the whole Catholic Church. It's just against a handful of corrupt Italian cardinals that did the wrong thing.
Something, too, John, we may not have time on this side, but we can always pick this up inside, too. But you had an interesting article on your website some months back. There was a long-standing imbroglio where Germany had been refusing to release a huge archive of documents about the Third Reich. For some 60 years, they kept it quiet. You had some interesting things to say about why that was kept under wraps.
Yeah, because a lot of the, and these were Jewish archives. Why would they keep Jewish archives secret? These were people that, you know, had disappeared into the Holocaust, and their families were trying to find out what happened. You know, why not tell them the truth? Well, the truth is that a lot of those Jews that did die, their names were used by escaping Nazis. The Alt-Aussee concentration camp on the border of Italy and Switzerland had a masterful collection of Jewish engravers and artists as prisoners of war. And they would put the faces of the escaping Nazis on these Jewish identity cards and allow them to escape. And that was the real reason why this dragged on so long, because so many of the dead are still alive. It would be very embarrassing, you know, with Google and, you know, worldwide searches to look up the name of your relative and find he's still living in Argentina when he was died in a concentration camp years ago.
So in other words, basically there are people who are ostensibly Jewish survivors of the Holocaust who are actually Nazis who have assumed victims' identities.
Yes, and there have been several cases discovered in Israel, for example.
Interesting. Very interesting indeed. John, tell us about your website, radio show, and books real quickly, and we'll resume the discussion on the other side of the program.
The next book coming out is called America's Nazi Secret by Trinday Publishing, and it's all the things that were censored out of my first book 30 years ago, and it's going to be very, very embarrassing for many segments of the government. And quite frankly, it shows that the whole Justice Department hunt for Nazis was a little bit of a fraud. My radio show is the johnloftusshow.com, and you can hear me live on WSNR AM 620 in New York City, Long Island, New Jersey, and all around the world at talklinecommunications.com, talklinecommunications.com. Just click on the John Loftus Show for our archives and podcasts.
And we're going to resume this discussion in Side 2. We've been speaking with John Loftus because this wraps up Side 1 of For the Record program number 706, interview with John Loftus, the Obama administration, as the last victim of World War II, being recorded on March 21st of 2010. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.